не смію ревати.
Luna, yeah, I'm gonna give you an update now, and I'm gonna give you another one before you go on the podcast. Like, there's nothing going on, really. I mean, there is a million police in the streets, yeah, and I have seen a lot of actos de repudio on social media going on, specifically targeting people from Archipiélago. But things are calm. A lot of people are, you know, that we're saying that we're going to protest have just posted photos of themselves wearing white clothes, and some of them with a white rose that Junior spoke about. So that's basically what's going on. Now, the other thing is, I saw some posts that said 3 p.m. as the time to, you know, to protest. I don't think people will go out, honestly. But, well, basically that's what's going on right now.
Welcome everyone to another episode of the Groundings Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Devin, and the voice you just heard was that of Daniel Montero. Daniel is a Cuban who lives on the island and is a producer with Belly of the Beast Cuba, an award-winning documentary series, executive produced by Oliver Stone and Danny Glover. You'll hear a little bit more from Daniel later. But first, I want to introduce you to Luna Olavarría Gallegos, someone who I have gotten to know over the past year or two, who does some really important work, especially centering around Cuba and sort of media hypocrisy, activist and comrade Luna. And so, Luna, before I continue to butcher an introduction for you, I'm wondering if you could go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is Luna Olavarría Gallegos. I've been working alongside Belly of the Beast for a few years. We're a media production house that does documentary films and investigative journalism, specifically dealing with issues of the U.S. blockade and the effects of an economic siege on the Cuban people. And in addition, I'm also really interested, like Devin mentioned, in media hypocrisy and media literacy and the ways in which young people across the globe get information through the internet.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate all that y'all do over at Belly of the Beast. And I genuinely mean that. I think for those of you who haven't seen it, make sure you go on YouTube and go to Belly of the Beast Cuba and check that out. Liz, the head journalist and host, just does a phenomenal job. The whole production, the storytelling, the journalistic integrity of it all is truly wonderful. And it, you know, I wish we had more content like that. So I really just want to start off by saying, like, I want everyone listening to go and watch it for sure. And we can really dive right in. So as we anticipate and prepare for a new season of the Groundings Podcast, I wanted to kind of hop in and do a special episode with Luna that's about the so-called, you know, pro-democracy, if you will, demonstrations that were supposed to happen today, November 15th, in Cuba, which have been called for by activists, some of them with shady connections to, like, the U.S. government, U.S. embassies. But before we dive too far into it and I get ahead of myself, Luna, I was really just want to ask you, you know, can you kind of give me the basics of what is happening on the ground and where this call for protest came from?
Yeah, I think I'm going to defer to my colleague, Danielle, who's a producer with Belly of the Beast. He is in Cuba right now, and it's November 15th. We're recording at 3:30 p.m., and he has not seen any. There have been no protests so far. And so regardless of the fact that the U.S. State Department has been practically promoting protests for weeks now, even threatened Cuba with more sanctions if they continue the so-called human rights abuses, There have not been protests, but the calls for protests actually started happening in July during the last time there were protests in Cuba. And these were unprecedented protests, but, you know, they're actually more complicated than just the way that the U.S. mainstream media characterizes them. So what happened was, on July 11th, there were unprecedented protests that erupted across Cuba. And in the U.S., most media organizations portrayed them as a cry for freedom against communism. Biden took the opportunity to pander to his Florida audience and talk a lot about Cuba as a failed state, but really the root causes of these protests were devastating economic crises that has pushed the Cuban people towards desperation. There's really a lot of lack of food and medicine on the island right now. So this is a lot of what the War on Cuba Part 2, which is episodes 4 through 6, really delve into.
Absolutely. And we do have a short audio clip from Daniel. And so I'm actually going to go ahead and play that now.
Junior Garcia is a Cuban playwright. He became relevant to the Cuban political context last year when he and a number of other artists had a sit-in in front of the Ministry of Culture. He also had his own protest last July 11th in front of the Cuban television. Now, after that, he created a Facebook group called Archipelago, which is the group where the protests have been called, basically. The thing is that whoever acquires a relevant position within some form of opposition to the Cuban government is immediately provided the support of mainstream media, mainly American, and also of American politicians. And even more than that, these protests, the United States government has said that if they did not occur, if repression happened, they would pursue further sanctions against Cuba. So Junior Garcia is at this point being used by the United States to maintain their war against Cuba. Now, this is particularly contradictory since Junior Garcia himself has said publicly that he opposes the United States embargo on Cuba. Whichever way you choose to see this, the United States is openly intervening in the internal issues of the country by backing whoever acquires any relevance within the opposition. I would even dare say it damages such opposition more than actually helping them.
Again, that was Daniel Montero. Thank you so much, Daniel, for your words and for contributing. And just to put in a little bit of context, Daniel was speaking about a character who has sort of made himself the face of the demonstrations today, Junior Garcia Aguilera, who has direct links to some U.S.-backed Miami Gusano organizations, as well as potential links to one Ramon Saul Sanchez. Junior also worked with Cuba Proxima, a platform which openly calls for a restoration of capitalism on the island in the guise of democracy. And he's on the board with members who have openly called for U.S. annexation of Cuba, as well as U.S. military intervention, among other things. Anyways, back to the program. One thing that I found really interesting about these protests, you know, one, actually, I should say, I think they're getting easier and easier and easier to see through. And in some ways, the CIA is in their flop era, you know, and this feels like it's once again another flop. But the day before the protests even took place, you know, they were planned on the 15th. On the 14th, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken actually tweeted as if he could see into the future and was already calling the so-called, you know, demonstrations, quote, peaceful, and condemning the Cuban government for showing any kind of strength against these protests, and really kind of laying the ideological groundwork to manufacture consent for these protests before they even took place, which to me is like a clear example of just the shady nature of the organizers being in direct communication with some of these people, most likely. And so, you know, I'm wondering if you have any kind of other general consensus of how Cubans on the ground feel. I know that obviously we don't want to generalize, but there does seem to be a general sentiment against these demonstrations.
Danielle mentions people wearing white, which is like a symbol that has been used by certain people on the ground to signify, you know, what they think of as peaceful protests. This is obvious, you know, it's clear there are some people on the ground who are against their government, as every government on Earth have people that are against their government. But he also mentions that there are people who are very pro-government, pro-revolution, who are going and making really broad public statements and acts of resistance against these protests. So this is what he's describing when he's talking about the people who are going to the House of Dissidents. And in their eyes, they're defending their government and they're defending, you know, their government's right. The issue that I see that's actually like a broader issue is the fact that these are very localized conflicts that are a little bit difficult to understand if you're in the United States, because they're very specific to the country and the context and the political context that exists in this country is one in which there's been an embargo since economic embargo on the country since the moment that it was freed from essentially neo-colonialism and neo-slavery. So as soon as that happened, they had this economic embargo on them. And because of this embargo, which is like a boot on someone's neck, all of the hyper-local conflicts and disagreements in between different ideologies and opinions are really painted over with this elephant in the room issue, which is the fact that there's an economic blockade. So the United States is actually using different Cubans as essentially tools for their continuing of this, of their attempts to change the regime, essentially. So every year, the United States gives around $20 million a year to fund democracy promotion programs, which is just another word of saying regime change programs. And this affects every aspect of Cuban life, as well as the economic blockade. As I mentioned before, it's very hard to get medicine and food on the island and petroleum. These regular people are being affected by these political policies in the United States, first Trump and now Biden, and even before Trump, obviously. But really, there are a diversity of opinions on the island, but as North Americans, and specifically as U.S. Americans, what we should really be focused on is the fact that every single individual, no matter if they're communist or capitalist or anti-government or pro-government, have to live the effects of the U.S. blockade. So for me, that's really important to center, because no matter what kinds of discussions are going on the ground and back and forth and defense of the revolution or resistance against what they would call like the revolution, it's all of these people will be affected by the U.S. blockade.
Definitely. And, you know, it's really that sort of imperialist American chauvinism that allows for such a flattening of political complexity in this situation. I think that the understanding of the complexity of the situation when you're on the ground in Cuba is light years ahead of the sort of conversations people tend to have about it here in the States. And of course, that's the case for anywhere, you know, the locality of the politics is deeply important. But there's a way that being sort of from the belly of the beast, if you want to call America that, you know, it certainly obscures how you even approach Cuba as this sort of revolutionary or post-revolutionary society. And so you kind of touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to ask, you know, the context. I mean, we have the blockade, and just I want to give the listeners an example, because I think the blockade sounds very theoretical or high level to some people, but I want people to really understand that it affects like the day-to-day lives. just to give a quick example, a few years ago when I was in Cuba, it was right after Barack Obama had sort of eased the travel restrictions a little bit for Americans. And, you know, there was a boom once again in the tourism sector. In Matanzas alone, I was there and there were over 300 active construction projects taking place. And this is in one province, just 300. I mean, the money they get sort of goes back into restoration a lot of times of like buildings and infrastructures. Fast forward a few years later, I returned just a few weeks after Trump's sort of ratcheted up Cuba policies, where they reverted back to older G.W. Bush policies. And there were, it was like a complete night and day difference from what you see and what you experience. You know, there were certain food items missing from the shelves. The lines, you know, the Cuba is known for having long lines for everything. The lines once again got long for certain items in certain places, right? So it's a direct impact what the U.S. does, you know, policy wise. It's a direct impact on Cuba. The blockade is both a grand statement and an individual attack for Cubans and the Cuban people. But with that said, I wanted to ask the context of these, you know, this current call for demonstrations. It's kind of fizzled out, like we've already said. It seems to be more popular in Miami than in Havana or in Cuba. I'm also wondering, you know, is this connected to those in any kind of way? The protests that we saw earlier this year in July, is there any kind of connections? Is it similar groups? You know, anything like that? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, there would be no November 15th protest without the July 11th protest. July 11th protest really did lay the groundwork for a lot of different individuals and groups to rise to a sort of visibility within Cuba and also in the United States. After the July 11th protests, Biden, again, for the purpose of pandering to his Cuban-American extremist audience in Florida, which he's hoping to win over, invited a rapper who was a so-called leader in the initial protest to the White House. One example of obvious pandering. No other political activist from any other country is invited to the White House. In that way, yes, they're very connected. But really, I want to go back to what you mentioned about manufactured consent, because really a lot of what's happening is perhaps the level at which so-called activism or dissidency in Cuba is playing out would not exist without the American media. So, Devin, you've been to Cuba. You know that there's internet, and you've written extensively about the healthcare in Cuba and the medical system. So you know that if there's one thing Cuba doesn't need, it's vaccines, and they also don't need internet. But after the protests, Biden began to promise to help the Cuban people by bringing them internet and vaccines. It's this kind of insidious lie and just, they're baseless claims, lies that are helping lay down, you know, an infrastructure essentially of just, you know, baseless propaganda pro the United States. And when we don't have context for how people live in Cuba, when we don't actually know what's happening on the ground, it's easy for us as Americans who, you know, are not as politically educated as we should be or as aware about what's happening in other countries to just believe these baseless claims. So in a way, like, the American media has been manipulating its own citizens and its own people within its country in order to push a narrative which, without this infrastructure, perhaps these protests wouldn't exist in the same way. So if you ask, I'm sure if you ask even the people who wanted to protest today, if you ask them, do you want vaccines, do you want internet, they would say no. And this is kind of part of these lies have been bolstered by the Biden administration in order to push this narrative. The other thing I did want to say is that Biden promised to reinitiate the Obama era policy that you spoke about earlier when he ran for presidency, and he's totally abandoned this promise. And it's really important for everyone in the U.S., specifically people who are able to coherently make political decisions, to know this, because these lies that are just told through the media and through the political apparatus are really affecting people abroad. This is not just happening in Cuba on the ground. These are things that are happening through U.S. American media, through the political infrastructure, and then kind of pushed out and affecting people everywhere else.
Cuba's internet, which is through a fiber optic cable that literally connects them via Venezuela, is actively threatened by the U.S. itself, who often threatens to cut that cable and quote unquote revert Cuba back to the Dark Ages. So it's so interesting that this rallying cry has even mentioned that issue when the U.S. often tries to hold that as leverage against them. And at the same time, you know, a little protest with some people gets blown up across the Today Show, and Vice News does documentaries about it and all of these things. But when you hear about Cuba effectively vaccinating, I think, 95% of their population or 100% of their population, and, you know, the positive aspects of the Cuban healthcare system, for example, why don't they ever get the same coverage that these other things get? So they've clearly demonstrated a capacity to cover Cuba in the mainstream media. They've clearly demonstrated a capacity to engage with the topic of Cuban politics. But it's on whose terms, from what angle, and for what purpose is always the question that listeners and viewers should ask themselves, right? Why is it that you have to go to Telesur or Belly of the Beast to know about Cuba's free college and free and their medical missions and all these things? But if they're having a protest, a U.S.-backed protest, you suddenly hear about it everywhere, right? So it seems like one of those would be the one that everyone would know about, but it's usually the opposite. So I know we've been talking for a little bit. I'm not going to keep you too much longer, but I did want to ask, we've talked about sort of the blockade a lot, and I'm curious, how does like U.S. neocolonialism, the blockade being the sort of most effective neocolonial tool they have, how does that play a role in what we're seeing now with this sort of civil unrest complexity that people were talking about?
Belly of the Beast is putting out a zine soon, written as a response to the claims that Cuba is a racist state. It was written by Liz Oliva Fernandez a few months ago, and this was, you know, there was a lot. I don't know if maybe if you've been keeping up with Cuba, you know that a lot of Black Lives Matter endorsed, you know, Cuba's right to be a sovereign country. And this was met with a lot of resistance, and people said Cuba's a racist state. And I think it fits into your question, because Liz has a line in this chapbook that's really resonated with me, which is essentially that the U.S. American abolitionist that we love, Ruthie Gilmore, has identified clearly that the danger of racism is groups or the state being able to cause premature death based off of race. And the blockade in this way is a racist force, because it stops flows of goods and movements, which are a matter of life and death, onto an island with a large population of Black people. So when we talk about the blockade, I think it's really important to see it as obviously something that affects everyone in Cuba, regardless of class, political status, political leaning, gender, race. It affects everyone, but it also it specifically affects, this is an island, post-colonial island, of people who are descendants of slaves, of people who are descendants of cane cutters, and this blockade still exists to punish the fact that there was a revolution that made everyone literate, made everyone have a good standard of living, regardless of your race, regardless of if your grandparents were farmers or not. I think it's important for us when we, beyond the fact that a blockade should not exist against any people on earth, beyond that, it's also important to see it as a racist force.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess the phrasing, you know, like the blockade itself is a racist entity. Yeah. Like it is an act of racist violence itself. You know, a Cuban comrade of mine, Marisa Lopez McBean, she explained to me one time, like, when it comes to topics of race and gender, despite Cuba having made massive leaps on many fronts, it still has a lot of work to do. And the way she explained it is that one aspect of the blockade is that it intentionally hinders the ability to properly do works on the front of racism, of gender equity, and these different things. So the same way we kind of praise the healthcare system for achievements within a blockade or despite a blockade, you know, the achievements when it comes to like race, gender, those too have persisted to progress despite the blockade, which itself is this racist, sexist, homophobic entity. And I think it's interesting and important that people really see it framed like that. Also, you know, the U.S. isn't slapping blockades and sanctions on majority white countries around the world either. Like, that's also an aspect to think about, too.
Yeah, and people like perhaps Manitza or Liz will also speak about how the blockade disproportionately affects these communities that are more at the margins because of the nature of just lack of resources. And so I think we all really want to be in a world in which we can communicate and dialogue with our Cuban comrades, deep, you know, ideas around race and gender. And it's difficult to exchange now because of this blockade, which is also a travel blockade, an idea blockade, which is also these issues of identity are also used against the state as talking points, which is ironic because it is one of the only countries in this hemisphere and in the whole world that has eliminated certain markers of race and class and gender-based discrimination in a way that no other country has. So it's really phenomenal. And at the same time, there's so many constraints to which we can talk about publicly with our counterparts in Cuba because of this blockade and because it's such a pressing issue just to lift it so that people can have their basic needs met in a way that's that the original people who fought for this revolution intended. You know, they wanted the ability to live with dignity, even if you're poor, even if you come from farmers, or even if you come from slaves, because of this, again, like a boot on the neck, we're unable to dialogue on that level because it's really just about like this pressing issue.
Yes, I've told friends recently, like, you're in the position of an outsider. The conversation, what can you bring to these people beyond, or that's more than demanding of your own government's complicity in their situation be reprimanded, you know? And so thank you for putting that into perspective and for really helping to break that down. You know, can you tell viewers what's coming up with Belly of the Beast and, you know, tell us more about that?
Thank you. So we're in the process of releasing part 2 of Belly of the Beast, which is episode 4, 5, and 6. And these episodes were also executively produced by Oliver Stone and Danny Glover and took, you know, a large group of our team that's Havana based to make it. So we're really excited about being able to produce anything with the kind of restrictions we have, all of the economic issues and so on. But essentially episode 4 really delves deep into these mysterious health incidents that were dubbed Havana syndrome or sonic attack. These happened in 2017 and they led to the U.S. embassy closing. But in our episode, we really go into how the U.S. government manipulated and concealed scientific evidence that would have dismantled these baseless claims that diplomats were attacked by a sonic microwave weapon. So that's episode 4. And then episode 5 goes into all of the background of the unprecedented protests that happened in July 11th in Cuba. And like I said, most of the media organizations in the U.S. portray the demonstrations as a cry for freedom, against communism or pro-democracy. But in this episode, we really go into the root causes, which are these devastating economic sanctions that really push people to talk. And then episode 5 exposes the disconnect between U.S. policy and what's happening in Cuba. So like I said, after the protest, Biden has offered to help the Cuban people with vaccines, with internet, and it's really, like you said, like manufactured consent, just a way to get the American people on board with something that is not correct. And then that episode also goes into the fact that Biden totally abandoned his promise to reinstate Obama-era policy, which is what a lot of people had hoped for in Cuba. And so those are the three episodes, and we are having a screening with Black Alliance for Peace this Saturday. And we'll have Erica Ryan of Hood Communists in conversation with Liz, and they will go more into these issues of identity and race and the blockade and what U.S. Americans can do.
First off, let me just say, Erica Ryan is one of my best friends, and I did not know she was involved. That's my A1 since day one, my homegirl. So I'm really excited to check that out. Me and her have been having a lot of backstage, behind the scenes conversations about Cuba over the last year, especially with this onslaught of this sort of Black Cubans need U.S. intervention narrative that they've been trying to spin. So I'm really excited for that, and thank you for telling what's coming up. Can you tell real quick the social, what's the Twitter maybe, and the Instagram, and where people can find Belly of the Beast or yourself if you want?
Belly of the Beast is at Belly of the Beast Cuba on Instagram, and on Twitter, Belly Beast Cuba.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much again for your time. Everyone listening, go check out Belly of the Beast. Tweet, post, do whatever you can in support of Cuba. Even if the demonstration is a flop, the Cuban government still needs support because the imperialist onslaught is constant. With that, this has been another episode of the Grandmans Podcast. Peace.